I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Pennsylvania has a new school mask mandate.
Doing nothing right now to stop COVID-19, that's just not an option. Doing nothing is going to mean more sick kids. It's going to mean more days out of school. It's going to mean more grief for our communities and more problems for our economy. When kids are forced to quarantine at home, parents have to call off work. And again, that's bad for our workplaces. It's bad for them. It's bad for all of us. We have to act now to protect our students and our teachers. We need to put politics aside. We need to get back to what matters: keeping students safe and keeping students in the classroom.
That was Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf on Tuesday announcing the mask mandate for teachers, staff, and students at all public and private schools and child care centers taking effect next Tuesday. Now, most K through 12 schools have already reopened. Earlier this summer, Wolf had said decisions about mask mandates were up to individual school districts and more recently had called on the legislature to enact a mandate, which they did not do. There's talk now among Republicans about a court challenge to Wolf's mask mandate. The mandate was issued by the acting health secretary, Allison Beam, who joins us on Radio Times. Nice to have you with us on the show.
Good morning, Marty. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing well, thanks.
Why did the governor change his mind about mask mandate?
Sure. So this has been a progressive engagement, realizing that we would always want this to be a local leadership decision, but we also know that as of the beginning of August, only 59 of 474 school districts had taken the CDC's advisement and adopted it to include a mask mandate within their school district. And at that stage, we were also watching as the case counts increased with the spread of the Delta variant, particularly in our pediatric population. We then worked to try and call upon the legislature to take action, realizing that some of the school districts even fell back on the fact that the state had not taken action yet as their reason not to put a mask mandate in place. And when there was failure to act by the legislature, the governor stepped in.
How are you going to enforce this mask mandate? And can you and do you want to do that?
So we are working to keep kids safe and keep them in school. And this is really something that we have worked very closely with our Department of Education to understand how we could best serve to support leadership as they implement any sort of mandatory masking requirements that we put forward. Really, what we've been able to do is, I think, first put out the order requiring it, but then allow the schools to be able to abide by it in a way that they would put forth a dress code policy, or even as some of our schools have with nut-free policies within their cafeteria. School officials really are going to be the ones who make sure that their students remain safe and comply with this masking order.
Well, Central Bucks, which is, I believe, the second largest school district in the Commonwealth, rejected a mask mandate by parents, just using that as an example. Is there an enforcement part of this mandate, or are you hoping to appeal to people's sense of public health?
Well, of course, we would love to appeal to the sense of public health and have that be enough. But we also know, and using Central Bucks as an example, that having the parents also be able to have an ability to act. And so school officials who fail to adhere to the order could lose the protection of sovereign immunity and may personally face lawsuits, just as they are in Central Bucks, from those who may be affected by an official's attempt to ignore that order.
Just to make sure our listeners understand that, you're saying that these individuals could be sued by parents and it would essentially be on them to defend themselves?
Yes, they may face lawsuits from those parents.
Now, schools have opened, and this is, of course, before the mandate. Is there any evidence or even data about whether we're seeing a spike in school-related COVID cases?
Sure. As you know, Pennsylvania has some of the latest school openings, and so we're right now experiencing a lot of that back-to-school data coming in real time. But we do know that in Pennsylvania, more than 6,500 school-age kids, 5 to 18, have tested positive for COVID-19 in the past 14 days. And so as we're still understanding that there's some schools that don't even come back until after Labor Day, we have already seen an increase in that testing positivity within our school-age population.
That's a lot of students. Now, can we say that those were students in schools that didn't have masks?
So what we're again, wanting to be very accurate in is we are still having schools open right now. And so for a lot of our masking efficacy, we're relying upon the data that has been driven from other states. And so, for example, down the Greater Atlanta Public School System just reported that compared with schools with optional versus mandatory mask policies, after the first 2 weeks of school, found a threefold decrease in COVID test positivity rates in the schools requiring masks. And so while we are somewhat reliant upon how other states are actively calculating the efficacy of masks, given how late we are to open some of our schools, we're already seeing that where schools have put in place mandatory masks, they've been able to control against the transmissibility of COVID-19.
Let me ask you about distancing in schools, ventilation in schools. Has your department looked at that particular issues? Obviously, vaccines and masks are critical to this, but so are some of these other factors. What should we know?
So let's be clear. The most effective way of protecting everyone, students and school staff alike, is by vaccinating the adults around them. And so we have not let our foot off the gas on our vaccination campaign, and we still would highly encourage everyone to go get vaccinated to be able to protect our communities broadly. But specific to your question about also ventilation, social distancing, and the like, the CDC's guidance this school year has been able to appreciate a layered approach. So understanding that with each measure taken, you mitigate the risk of having a student, one, have to quarantine, or potentially, two, become sick from COVID-19 or worse. And so being able to say, vaccinations, hands down, most important. Masking is another important piece of that, as is ventilation, as is making sure that folks can be socially distanced when able. Though we know that ventilation and social distancing is hard to secure for some of our school districts given their facilities.
Do we know, or do you know, how many adults working in schools are vaccinated? What percent are vaccinated?
Sure. So as you can recall, this spring, we were able to have a wildly successful vaccination initiative for our educator community. We were at that point able to get over 112,000 teachers, educators, volunteers vaccinated that would be able to, again, protect them as we think about heading back into the school year. That's roughly an 80% capturing of our educator community. And so we want to keep them protected, and now we're keeping our eye on allowing ourselves to ensure the same sort of access to boosters and any additional vaccination doses that the federal government recommends for them. But we realize that that's still one in five teachers who may not be vaccinated, which, again, has the capacity to really transmit the virus within the classroom.
What can you do about that? For instance, here at WHYY, you cannot be in this building unless you're vaccinated.
So first, thank you to WHYY. We cannot be gracious enough with all of the actions that have been taken in the private sector to push for vaccinations. Our role and our main mission has been to make that vaccine as accessible as possible, but also to break down any barriers by way of changing hearts and minds. And so educating, communicating, making sure it's not just our voices saying this, that it's the people that you interact with on a daily basis saying, yes, go get the vaccine. It's safe. It's effective. It's how we get our country back to normal. That has been seen to be our most effective means to getting folks vaccinated, and we're continuing on that mission.
I'm thinking about this mask mandate for schools in Pennsylvania, and one can imagine in the classroom that would work. What about things like sports or singing in a chorus or being part of a theater group or going to the lunchroom, for instance? How do masks factor into that?
Absolutely. So I want to be explicitly clear. Our mask mandate has an exception for individuals participating in sports. The mask mandate does not apply in that setting. Realizing that there are still other instances indoors, which is where the mask requirement is currently confined to, that people will have to take down their masks. It's in the cafeteria when you're eating lunch, and it's when you're playing a certain musical instrument. We get that. And there are exceptions for those circumstances within the order. But ultimately, what we want to make sure of is that as many students are protected as often as possible by having that consistent and correct mask wearing by as many students as possible indoors.
What about parents who, let's say, have children at risk or are at risk themselves? They're in a district where there will not be a mask mandate in spite of what your office has done. What recourse do they have?
Sure. So I will go back just to make sure everyone understands where parents are actually empowered to take action as well. So for any school official who fails to adhere to this order, they could lose that protection of sovereign immunity and could face personal liability from those who are affected. And so those are the parents with those children that are at risk. Likewise, understanding that this order applies not just to the K-12 setting indoors, but also to our child care providers, our Department of Human Services has also been able to take action against the license of any of our child care providers who are not abiding by this order. And so multiple channels for powers or for parents to pursue.
I'm curious about if you're anticipating a policy for a vaccine when it becomes available for children. It's now just available for children 12 and older. Would that also become a mandate, a requirement, frankly, like other vaccines?
Sure. So for those 12 and older right now, they are able to go get fully vaccinated. And Pennsylvania has been able to secure 39% of our 12 to 17-year-olds have been able to get vaccinated, which is tremendous. And we just want to thank all of those individuals before heading back into the school year that they got vaccinated. What we are going to see over the next fall and likely into the winter months is that the vaccine will be approved for younger and younger ages. But at this stage, there's no contemplation of requiring the vaccine. Rather, we want students and parents alike to go seek it. And so our role will be just as it was with the adult rollout, which is we're going to make it as accessible as possible. We're going to communicate and educate as much as we can and have this really be embedded in the community. And so parents and students feel empowered to go get vaccinated rather than have the requirement on them.
I know in about a month or so, you're going to sort of look and see how this policy was enacted and what kind of impact it will have. What kind of data do you think you'll be able to get for that?
Absolutely. So as I'm sure you recognize, the Department of Health studies the evolution of our data every single day. And so we are really at this point wrapped with attention around our cases, around our hospitalizations, understanding where there's any increase in pediatric strain, making sure that there's pediatric access across the board, not just for any individual that unfortunately contracts COVID-19, but for any school-aged child who needs access to health care broadly. We want to make sure that Pennsylvania preserves that. And of course, unfortunately as well, watching our death data. Additionally, we really want to be able to understand the quarantining impacts on students. Putting on a mask is going to lower the number of students that have to be quarantined, which means that we're going to be able to preserve that in-person education that all of us so greatly want for our kids. We're going to be able to preserve all of the sports that they want to be able to continue to partake in this fall. And so we're also going to be watching that data as we progress through school opening, where there are unfortunately outbreaks, how we can help control against them with any further policies.
Allison Beam, we have to leave it there. Thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. She is acting health secretary for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. We're after the short break.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We just said goodbye to Allison Beam, the acting health secretary for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, and issued a mask mandate for all schools in the Commonwealth just a day or so ago. Now, most K-12 schools in Pennsylvania have opened, even as the COVID pandemic is spiking, driven in part by the more infectious Delta variant and by the unvaccinated. This poses a threat to children 12 and under because a vaccine has not yet been approved for them. That is why Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf announced a mask mandate this week for all schools and child care centers in the Commonwealth, joining New Jersey and Delaware and other states. Nonetheless, there are concerns and questions about how to keep young people safe while they're back in the classroom. playing sports and singing in the chorus and eating in the lunchroom. Joining us now is pediatrician David Rubin. He's director of the Children of CHOPS Policy Lab, and I should say that CHOPS stands for Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. He's a professor of pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine, and we have called him up from time to time during the pandemic to get the latest from him. And David, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be here.
And to our listeners, I want to make sure you can join us with any questions or comments. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499, especially if you are a parent. So, David Rubin, give us your response to the mask mandate in Pennsylvania.
Well, look, you know, as you know, we've worked at Policy Lab with many schools throughout the region. We've seen independent schools, we've seen public schools, both in the city and then outside in the suburbs. And, you know, we deeply believe in local flexibility. I've gotten to see it firsthand how each school community is assessing its own risk and the risk tolerance of its communities. We have some very highly vaccinated high schools, for example, that were looking for more flexibility this year, et cetera. But what we've always stated is during a period of substantial transmission, the risk in terms of quarantine, you heard the secretary talk about this. We're seeing it already from the South, large quarantines and disruptions of school that include not just the students, but the staff there. If there are no bus drivers to bring kids to schools, et cetera, that the use of masks as part of a layered mitigation strategy that also considers pushing vaccinations and the use of testing and ventilation, those things can help blunt the peak and help assure that we are not disrupting school. Unfortunately, now we find a situation where all the counties in Pennsylvania are really at substantial transmission, and we have significant rising transmission that we're forecasting on our own models. Finally, I would say also when you look at the South in terms of areas like Georgia and Tennessee, they've had a significant second bump, even despite all the quarantines, not just in adult hospitalizations, but particularly in the pediatric hospitalizations that we've seen. And for all those reasons, you know, requiring masks at the beginning of the school year to try to blunt this peak as students return to school, makes sense. I think we would do that with the caveat that we need to continue revisiting these requirements and mitigation strategies, because this is going to be a fluid situation as the year unfolds. There'll be times when transmission is going down, and as community rates start to fall again, I think the idea of returning local flexibility will make sense. But right now is not one of those times, and our goal right now is to manage transmission through what's likely going to be a difficult opening month for these schools.
And difficult opening month, meaning you see this continued spike in COVID, and particularly a threat to children?
Well, you know, to me, I think we worry more about the children and their risk to helping contribute to community transmission. And we're seeing that certainly in this wave. I do want to reassure your listeners, though, Marty. I know we're seeing a lot of anecdotal stories from the South of children in the ICUs. There's been some more deaths recently. But numerically, when you look at what's going on, we just have more children largely unvaccinated in this country who are now transmitting COVID as they attend gatherings that are largely unmasked with both vaccinated and unvaccinated individuals. We shouldn't be surprised that kids are more represented in this way, but I want to reassure your listeners that the risk of severe disease still remains low in the kids themselves. Mm-hmm. Even in our region at CHOP, we continue to have a very low census of patients with COVID infection. It's not zero. It's high enough, and certainly what we've seen in the South, it's high enough to recommend vaccinations to kids as they become available, but we shouldn't develop an unnecessary fear about returning our kids to school.
I mean, should we think about masks and maybe even vaccinations as the way we think about seatbelts or car seats for children?
Well, I think most importantly, I think the secretary mentioned this, and I think it's really important. We actually, for those people who will visit our website at policylab.chop.edu, we included a nice graph that demonstrated that the best thing we can do, we focus on school policy, but the best thing to do to protect our kids this year is to have highly vaccinated communities. Mm-hmm. States that have had high vaccination rates among adolescents and adults have seen far fewer hospitalizations. I mean, Rhode Island this past week had no kids in the hospital.
Wow.
And so, you know, we have to keep in mind, even in our state of Pennsylvania, across such a large state, we were at a census of about 30 children across the entire state who are in the hospital. And so we acknowledge the need for a collective response that includes masking in some of these locations to keep schools in session and reduce community transmission, we have to acknowledge that the risk of severe disease to kids remains low.
Well, let me ask you about masks. And I've been reading more, and I'm sure you and others have as well, about, you know, the correct way to wear a mask, the correct kind of mask to have. And I'm thinking with children, you know, they don't always put them on, especially if they're little, you know, put them on correctly. What do we need to know about masks, especially dealing with this Delta variant?
Well, you know, first I would say in terms of masking, you know, I think our team has always believed that the best masks are really surgical masks. And there was a nice study that was published this week from overseas that demonstrated the value of surgical masks in reducing transmission. I always encourage families to think about, they're readily available using surgical rather than cloth masks. But as far as the Delta is concerned, I mean, certainly Delta has been a much more contagious virus than prior strains. But sometimes I think we give Delta too much credit for what's going on right now. And I think it's important because it makes us seem defenseless. Truthfully, you know, it's hard to distinguish the increased contagiousness of Delta from the fact that we are largely in an unmitigated stance. We've returned to normal everywhere else in our lives. We're having large gatherings, and a lot of the transmission we're seeing has been accelerated, in this unmitigated state. The addition of some layers of mitigation can really start to blunt these peaks. And I think it's important for folks to realize that this can be fluid, and this is all about managing transmission this year. And that we are well equipped through, you know, select use of masking at times of high transmission, the use of testing, which I think needs to be emphasized, ventilation, adjustments to ventilation, and just smart common sense to kind of get through sort of the worst periods of this, and then get along to later in the year when hopefully a lot of flexibility returns.
I hear what you're saying about masks, and obviously surgical masks would be the best protection. You see little kids with their Sesame Street characters on their mask, or, you know, Disney characters. I mean, are we overly obsessed about sort of the quality of a mask? Is it just a covering good enough?
Well, I think there's subtle differences. I think that's a fair point, Marty. I think that there's subtle differences. And I do think that schools have come up with creative ways to get kids to participate in the use of masks and how they do it. And so it's not an absolute. It's not like cloth masks don't provide some protection. In the studies around cloth versus surgical masks, there may be some reduction in prevention there, but it still helps reduce the transmission, particularly through large droplets of COVID between and among individuals.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you and also make sure our listeners can join our conversation. That's David Rubin. He's director of CHOP's Policy Lab. He's a professor of pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. And his organization has been advising school districts on what to do to protect children, probably in staff as well, against the COVID virus. And we want to hear from you. Any questions or comments? There is now a mask mandate in Pennsylvania. New Jersey and Delaware already had one. So if any questions or comments about that, we want to hear from you. And again, you can join us by sending us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. I don't know how many times we've interviewed David Rubin, but a number of times over the last year and a half about this pandemic. Are you sick of being a kind of a broken record about what we should do and frankly can do to protect ourselves against the virus and to, you know, if we all sort of work together to actually contain this virus going forward?
Yeah, I don't think if fatigue is the word. I think that, you know, this remains a very fluid situation. This is a novel coronavirus and we're at a different point in this pandemic. And while we're starting out September bumpier than we realized, the calculus is a bit different this year. And there's probably kernels of truth coming from all sides to some degree. I think it's a fair statement that as communities become highly vaccinated, and certainly as we eventually get vaccinations to our younger kids, is the costs and benefits of continued restrictions in the context of schools. And so we shouldn't dismiss those out of hand. I think we just need to be smart and practical, recognizing when you have surging transmission and substantial transmission as cohorts of kids are about to mix, our goal is to keep kids in school. And I think when you get to the practical realities and you try to be finite and not look at some of these restrictions as indefinite, I think that's important to message that this year, that that we are going to be fluid in this. And we still have a lot of strategies available to us that we will get back to normal situations. And that is still the goal. And the goal is to allow more flexibility as the year goes on, certainly as we regain control of this pandemic.
Do we know that criteria? Can we know, like, let's say a district is 80 or 90% vaccinated and everyone is wearing a mask and transmission seems extraordinarily low? Is that when you can take your foot off the brake?
Well, I think that certainly it's a complicated formula, but when you distill it down, it's about your local community transmission, and it's not just your county transmission. We saw last year that municipally, in each of these districts, they were experiencing something very different, that private schools and public schools were experiencing very differently. But, you know, these school leaders, as they come back in September, it's sort of like what you're seeing a consensus of, we're going to brace for this. We're gonna take extra precautions, but then each of them are going to get a feel. How many cases are we actually seeing in our school? What are our municipal rates? What are our vaccination rates? And you know, it's hard to put a single number on that. But I think as communities get comfort with where they are, that's going to be. And as we regain control of transmission across the state, and hopefully abate the rising hospitalizations, particularly among our adults in the region, that we will have more of a nuanced conversation on how to return local control back to these communities to make those decisions about mask optional policies, for example. We have a lot more information in our region because we've promoted the use of testing through our Project ACID program and our work with the health departments in the region. The schools have a lot more information and they're able to very quickly identify potentially contagious individuals and be able to assure that that we don't have large clustered outbreaks through the schools.
Agnes asks, she says, in fact, we're having a child's birthday party. What do you suggest in terms of precaution, David Rubin?
Well, fortunately, you know, with the exception of yesterday with the storm, you know, we're still in a very moment of time where we can move outdoors. And when you look at the masking mandates, I would still reassure readers that the emphasis is on indoor masking in very crowded spaces. Outdoor, you know, the necessity for masking outdoors has not been well supported by the literature. And so, you know, I would encourage your reader to think about moving the party outdoors. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the simplest intervention you can do to reduce the risk of transmission at a birthday party.
A listener also has a comment just basically saying, what about the low percentage of schools with nurses in Philadelphia? And I wonder, David, if you have looked at that.
Well, it's always a challenge in terms of, you know, we work closely with the School District of Philadelphia, but I just admire, you know, we work with the school nursing department there, and, you know, they've also brought in other contractors to help them with regards to testing. With regards to help around supporting community vaccinations, I know you're going to talk to the Philly Teen Vax folks today.
Yep, a couple minutes.
I mean, really inspiring group, and we'll wait for that segment. But what I would say is really inspiring group, and my hat's off to all the school nurses through the region who've really just gone above and beyond their call over the last year and a half.
I was talking to the acting secretary about the mask mandate for schools. And then, you know, what happens when it comes to things like sports and you know, chorus and other activities that happen in school. And I'd just be curious, David, as a pediatrician yourself, what your thoughts are about that.
About sports in particular?
Yeah, about you know, where people are panting and singing and yelling.
Well, first I would say, look, you know, in some ways as adults have been offered vaccination in this country, I think we have to err on the side of normalcy this year. And so getting kids back to their normal lives, we have to acknowledge the impacts on social, you know, in terms of social isolation and all of what children have been asked to shoulder over the last year and a half because of the risk to adults in their lives. And so we're broadly supportive of the return of activities and sports. And erring on the side of normalcy, that may be a bit of a controversial statement, but erring on the side of normalcy. And, you know, these programs, whether they're extracurricular activities or sports, have at their advantage not just vaccination now, but they also have the advantage of testing and wide availability of testing like the NBA or the NFL might have, particularly in our region, to do some assurance testing if they're worried. If there's a community that's worried about it during substantial transmission, they can test their athletes weekly to assure that everything is going safely. But again, the risk of severe disease now is lower in kids. And so I think we have to err on the side of normalcy and return these activities and find other ways to layer some prevention strategies, you know, going outside, using testing, making sure you're in well-ventilated spaces. With the singers practicing, they can still wear masks while they're practicing. These help assure that we manage transmission. We're never going to eliminate it this year, but we can manage it, and we will get through and return kids to more normal lives as this year progresses on.
I think this has been a year of so many tests, you know, for all of us in terms of dealing with risk and with threat and with danger and, frankly, with this virus. But I think this whole issue about, you know, how much risk you can involve in your life is so critical to understand. And I think, David, for some people, there's, you know, this feels too risky. For some people, they feel like I can deal with it.
Yeah, I have to tell you, I worry more this year in some ways about people, you know, about unnecessary fear.
Right.
You know, as we're offering vaccinations to folks, the virulence of this disease is lowering, even if we're still having these large amplitude events in terms of a lot of resurgent transmission. And as the virulence goes down, I think I worry about a lot of folks who are unnecessarily fearful. And I think that can sometimes lead to unnecessary intervention when we need more pragmatism this year. And convincing people that this is a risk we'll never eliminate, but we can get it to a point where we can accommodate it in our lives. And I think that's the debate that's really at the center of a lot of public division right now, is when to make that switch.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, we have to take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation with David Rubin, again, director of CHOP's Policy Lab. He's a professor of pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. He's going to stay with us. We're going to be joined by Diana Coleman. She's a public health professional, co-creator of the Philly Teen Vax program. And we have one of the Vax ambassadors who's going to join us on Radio Times to talk about teenagers and COVID and vaccinations. Do stay with us and do send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We've been talking about the new mask mandate for school students, teachers, and staff in Pennsylvania. What can be done to keep children safe from the COVID virus while they're back in the classroom, with pediatrician David Rubin. Now, teenagers 12 and up have been approved to get the COVID vaccine, but many of them have questions and concerns. There's an innovative program in Philadelphia called Philly Teen Vax that uses teenagers as ambassadors to encourage their peers to get vaccinated. Joining us is Diana Coleman. She's a public health professional, co-creator of the program. And Diana Coleman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, how are you? Nice. Thank you for having me.
Well, you're very welcome. And also with us is Karen Abraham. She's a Philly Teen Vax Ambassador and a high school senior. And Karen Abraham, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Let me start with you, Diana, and then Karen, I want to get you in on the conversation. And then David, I'll scoop you in on the conversation as well. Diana, what's the thinking behind this innovative program?
The thinking behind it is just getting kids involved. Getting these kids involved in the pandemic has been important. It's been empowering and even healing. It's been a tough year for on many levels, just like David Rubin said. You know, this year has been an emotional roller coaster for a lot of our youth. So when the opportunity presented itself to get Philly youth involved in COVID mitigation and prevention, that's exactly what we decided to do.
And
go ahead.
No. Go ahead. Finish your thoughts. Sorry about that. Go ahead, Diane.
Oh, so these teen ambassadors, they're courageously providing COVID-19 and vaccination and health education using multiple platforms. And they're reimagining what community engagement looks like. And so we're proud of the work that they're doing within their communities, within their own homes, within their schools. They're definitely taking on a lot. But they recognize the importance of the work. They recognize the importance of their involvement in getting youth involved in this process to get us back to this sense of normalcy.
Karen, let me get you in on the conversation. You're one of these ambassadors. What are some of the questions, concerns, issues that some of the teenagers you have talked to have about this COVID vaccination?
A lot of them are just scared, honestly, and especially with questions regarding of how fast it was created, along with distrust within the medical field, honestly. It's a combination of a lot of things, fear mainly driving it, and rumors they're hearing online that people are spreading like wildfire.
What kind of rumors?
I would say it's a lot with the alternating of DNA, something about changing their DNA, how the vaccine, you're getting it, it's altering your DNA, basically, and that it can also make you like magnetic and stuff like that.
I'm curious what you say as an ambassador when you hear some of those concerns and you know, frankly, issues that are more like a conspiracy theory. What can you say in response?
First, I always start with having a simple conversation with them. And when we're having these conversations, it's so important to make them know that it is a safe place, that they won't be judged, and it's a place where they can come and have these questions. And I, most of the time, I do explain to them what's in the vaccine, mRNA, lipids, fat, and salt, sugars, and I talk to them about how they work in the vaccine and help create the immunity for you.
And their response has been?
It's 50-50. Some are just like, oh, I don't really care, you know. I believe it because I've seen it, you know. Right. And then there's other people that take the information and they go and look into it and they realize that, oh, that's totally right.
Karen, hold on. I want to go back to Diana and get David in on the conversation as well. Diana, I'm interested in the kind of training. I think we heard it from Karen, but the kind of training these vaccine ambassadors are getting.
So, first off, myself and my other co-creators, Sophia Collins, that works in the policy lab, and also Dr. Barbara Clock, that works at the school district. She's the medical director of the school district. And myself, you know, we worked together in collaboration with Philly Counts, and we created a curriculum. And so that was the first thing we did, was provided them with a curriculum so they could understand the anatomy of the vaccine and the emergency use authorization process. And also so they could learn about what some of these myths are and get, put the education behind it to debunk those myths so that they can explain those things on a peer level. Another thing we did was we took them to a couple of vaccine clinics, whether they were community-based vaccine clinics or the FEMA-run vaccine clinics at the convention center, so that they could see the differences between the different types of vaccine clinics for depending on the community that they were in and the community that they were serving. Then after that was about research, constantly doing research about what are some of the best things that we could do to debunk some of these myths. And these teens are the research. Yeah. You know, they're on social media platforms. That's where a lot of them are getting their information from. And so using those platforms to elevate and amplify their voices, and also them becoming ambassadors within their own communities and having those informed conversations with folks, what we've learned is that who the teens have relationships with are very important. So if those relationships are with social media, if those relationships are with their peers, if those close relationships with their families or community organizers or their teachers or some of their mentors, it's really important what those individuals, or even their doctors, their pediatrician, it's very important the messaging that they're getting from those individuals. And so social media is definitely one of those platforms that we use to help kids make informed decisions.
Fair enough. And let me go back to you, David Rubin. I mean, talk about trusted ambassadors, right? Teenagers talking to teenagers.
Well, I can tell you, you know, we tend to emphasize a lot the conflicts that we're having in our communities, but programs like Philly Teen Vax, you know, having been able to witness the growth of this grassroots program directed from the kids themselves, truly inspiring. And, you know, this is a moment of service. And it's very clear how to navigate successfully through the rest of this pandemic. And to see these kids really in their voices, taking that next step and trying to ensure that they get their communities as safe as possible for what could be a difficult fall and winter. Truly inspiring, and some of the best moments for me in the pandemic have been to watch groups like this.
Well, and what we heard from Karen was that we don't judge. I mean, if people come in with ideas that, you know, they really don't stack up, we do not judge. How important is that, David?
Really important. I think, you know, you have to respect where people come from. You just hope that people make information with good data, or make their choices based on, you know, using data that actually is true and reflects the science. But you can't judge their opinions. And I think coming from that mutual respect, I think, is an emphasis that I've seen out of this Philly Teen Vax program.
Karen, let me go back to you. I think a lot of adults listen to Dr. Fauci and they can kind of tend to believe what he has to say. Does he have any cred among teenagers?
A lot of people know him. That's the first thing.
Right.
But honestly, with teenagers, they tend not to care. I'm going to be honest. They don't care when big scientists or big people like that, especially in the older demographic, go on TV and talk, because it's like, oh, it's just another person speaking about the same thing, you know? And with teens, to reach them, you have to reach their friends and peers, because that's how you get the conversation started, honestly. With Philly Teen Vax especially, we try to make sure that we are talking to the kids and that they're understanding that we come from the same place, basically, and that we have that mutual respect and that open conversations with them. So with popular people talking about it, it needs to be something that the kids or the people, especially teens, know. So like Olivia Rodrigo, for example, when she went online and went to the White House and talked about it, it was a major step that she took. And it did did get the conversation going with teens about the vaccine, about COVID-19 especially.
That's fascinating. And I mean, do you think that more celebrities, singers, people that young people know should do that, Karen?
I think that they should at least acknowledge it and talk a little bit about it to get at least the conversation started. From there, they can always do the research, reach out to organizations like that, and go on to state and government sites that talk about COVID-19 and the vaccine, where they can get reliable information from.
Daniel, let me go back to you, and just to sort of underscore what Karen was saying about the importance of trusted people that young people, frankly, look up to, the important role that they play.
Absolutely. It's very important. The role that folks play, because again, that's who's influencing the teens, and the teens influence each other. You know, oftentimes adults, we're kind of fixed in our thinking and our way of being, and kids are so much more flexible and malleable, adaptable. And so that's what we're seeing with these youth. You know, we started out with planning teen vaccine events, because we were, you know, the teens were, you know, when we talked to them about, when we took them to the different vaccine clinics, that was one of the things they noticed. This feels very sterile. It feels like a hospital. It feels like a clinic. Okay, so how do we change that? And so they immediately started coming up with themed vaccine events that we call them instead of clinics. And so now kids are coming to proms, but they're getting vaccinated too. And they're being dressed in prom attire. Oh, it's a pep rally. And so now there's DJs and there's music. And so it feels good to them. So it started out with doing the themed events to try to allow the children to feel some sense of normalcy since they weren't in the school. We know we had a graduation themed with Dr. Ayla Stanford and things like that. We're going into the school district in collaboration with the school district and doing back-to-school events where principals are being dumped and things like that. So it started out that, and then it went to the children doing in-person and virtual workshops where they've actually created workshops to work with other teens and children to teach them about COVID mitigation and prevention and debunk those that misinformation. And now they're working on projects with the school district, like creating curriculum for them to implement into their school and you know, they're doing such great work, and they're also sitting with public health professionals and policymakers and educators and physicians, and actually telling them and talking to them and giving them feedback about how to reach teens. So this thing has evolved. And so if anything, these youths have taught us the importance of flexibility and reimagining what we think things should be. You have to expand your thinking, and you have to and embrace changes and embrace communities where and meet them where they're at. And these teens are doing that.
Oh, that's great.
And because of that, what we're noticing is that we're seeing the city of Philadelphia and other people beyond that replicate the work that the kids are doing. So, and it's great to be a part of that.
Indeed. I mean, it's really quite inspiring, I have to say. Karen, let me go back to you. You talked about social media. How do you use social media to counter some of the misinformation that's on social media?
Definitely opening up social media to a place where people can talk. So it's definitely having to make sure that your page or your whatever you're doing on social media is definitely opening to people so that they know it's a safe place. And that's like one of the major things we try to focus on when we talk to teens, that they know it's safe. And that with that, when I do social media and do it for Tilly Teen Vax, we try to make it as open for people to reach out to us, but also that we put information out there to start the conversation. For me personally, on my social medias, I've put polls and different things up, and we've used that information to see what in these areas that the kids are thinking and what conversations that we should start with the kids to see where their head's at, basically.
In a lot of ways, and some of the innovative things that they're doing, because they know that teens are doing it, is they're doing it through TikToks.
Right. I saw some of these TikToks. Yeah, they're pretty cool. Yeah.
Yeah, they're doing it through TikToks. They're doing it through skits, creating skits. They're doing it through creating music. So we have a couple of songs where, you know, people are doing it, you know, sending the messages through rap or through spoken word and poetry. So we're definitely trying to meet the teens where they're at. And if TikToks is it, then we're TikToking.
I hear you. I hear you, and I appreciate that. David, let me go back to you. And I'm looking at the clock here. I think we heard from the acting health commissioner something like 39 or 40% of teenagers in Pennsylvania are currently vaccinated. What's our goal? What should we be aiming for?
As many as possible. I think what we're seeing is as kids are increasingly affected in this wave, numerically you're going to see hospitalizations rise. And, you know, the virulence is of a sufficient magnitude that we would recommend vaccinations. I mean, this, you know, I also would say for the adolescents who have taken this vaccine, liberation is the word that I sort of see, freedom from anxiety that you might infect other family members, and being able to quickly get back to your normal lives. You know, so the goal is to get as close to 100% as possible, you know, and to try to provide the right information to families to make those choices. Yes, there is a very low but appreciable risk of some side effects. They are extremely manageable in kids. But even as people have highlighted some of the, you know, some side effects related to the vaccine, the counterfactual of the risk of what COVID does to you or your family is a lot more significant. So the goal is to get as many people as vaccinated as possible.
Well, you know, we have to leave it there. And my thanks to all three of you for joining us on Radio Times. Karen, Abraham, thank you for the work that you are doing. It's really terrific.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome.
I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. She's an ambassador for Philly Teen Vax. She's also a high school senior. Diana Coleman, thank you for joining us and for this program as well.
Thank you for allowing us to be here.
No question about it. And she's a public health professional and also co-creator of the Philly Teen Vax program. And David Rubin, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Anytime.
You're welcome. Director of CHOP's Policy Lab, Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. And we began our show today with Allison Beam. She's Acting Secretary of Health for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, talking about the mask mandate in Pennsylvania. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the program. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Tina Calique and Diana Martinez, the engineers for today's edition of Radio Times. The show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marnie Moscoe. Thank you for joining us.